Is this a phase that America is going through, or something that's going to become more deeply entrenched?
It's extremely hard to see right now in the United States how you could ever get meaningful political reform. And so there's a constant drift between the political institutions, which are ossified, and the ever-evolving needs of the society, including widening inequality and the climate challenge and all of these questions that seem to demand a kind of action that the American Constitution seems incapable of responding to.
250 years ago, on July the 4th, 1776, 13 British colonies declared independence from the British Crown and established a republic dedicated to the inalienable right of men, created equal, to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The USA was born, speaking the language of Shakespeare, with many of its citizens having British parentage, but growing into a very different country, exemplified that this landmark date has become a moment of deep doubt and self-questioning as much as celebration. The Republic is no longer, as it self-confidently proclaims itself, humanity's last best hope, united by a commitment to democracy and freedom because all men are created equal. Instead, it's ravaged by chronic social and political polarization. So what to make of these cross currents? Is Trumpism, political polarization, and repudiation of concern for truth and social fairness simply a phase the US is going through as it has in the past, and from which it will emerge rejuvenated? Or are deeper and more ominous forces at work? What might this reveal about the broader trajectory of the US in the 21st century? And what will be the impact on British culture and thought? Here to help us explore these questions is the Edward Osborne Professor of US Politics and Political History at the University of Oxford and the Director of the Rothermere American Institute, Professor Adam Smith. He's a prominent historian who, aside from his seminal books and articles, regularly appears on many radio documentaries. He also hosts a great podcast, The Last Best Hope, which draws its title from Abraham Lincoln's famous quote. Adam.
Hi, Will.
Gosh, where to begin? I mean,
that was quite a bleak introduction you gave us there.
Maybe it's too bleak. I mean, I am aware of America's embrace of the modern. I'm aware of its dynamic capitalism. I'm aware of its technological kind of get up and go. I admire the seven mad companies, but at the same time, I find the polarization of American life and the disinformation, and I guess I'm as upset as many mainstream Americans at where this fantastic country is going. But having chided me, kind of develop your argument.
Well, I don't necessarily disagree with your bleakness, and I agree with what you've just said there. I would say that the thing that strikes me most, that I worry most about when I look at the United States, as you do from across the Atlantic, but being very engaged with it, and in my case, studying it and visiting it regularly, the thing that worries me most is the political constitutional stagnation, which stands in such stark contrast to the dynamism of its capitalist society, as you've just articulated it. This is a country that by some measures is the oldest continually operating constitution, has the oldest continually operating constitution in the world. I think maybe San Marino has an older set of operating documents. But unlike, and that is striking enough, but unlike at various other points in American history when there were periods of constitutional creativity and the institutions seemed malleable and there seemed to be the capacity for reform and renewal, it's extremely hard to see right now in the United States how you could ever get meaningful political reform. And so there's a constant drift between the political institutions, which are ossified, and the ever-evolving needs of the society, including widening inequality and the climate challenge and all of these kinds of questions that seem to demand a kind of action that the American Constitution seems incapable of responding to.
Yes, I was struck by that as I kind of briefed myself on your work, that, I mean, the growth of originalism, which was a kind of minority sport of a few lawyers kind of 40, 50 years ago, and is now, I mean, mainstream, with the Supreme Court kind of making judgments based on kind of how one should understand literally the original meaning of the founding fathers and the profundity of the conservatism that produces. You know, the Supreme Court will strike down states who try to qualify the freedom to kind of carry arms. Any measure of gun control is always tricky because it offends a constitution written in the late 18th century. I mean, it's extraordinary. As you've laid it down, you know, dynamism of society, sclerotic constitution, the two in tension. But could you just kind of make that live for us as a, you know, what that means in day-to-day life, what that actually means to the United States of America?
It's a massive generator of political tension and disaffection. So there are all kinds of ways in which the American political system nevertheless provides kind of pockets of excitement and regeneration. And you see what's happened in New York City since the election of Mamdani at the end of last year. The radical decentralization of the Constitution, I think, which is something we might want to talk a little bit more about, still provides kind of points of resistance and tension. But at the end of the day, as you've just been saying about the Supreme Court, and given the massive malapportionment of the United States Senate and the frustrations over the Electoral College, which is now twice in the 21st century elected a president who lost the popular vote. These kinds of things seem are so kind of weighty and create a sort of displaced energy in American society that, unlike in other countries, and it's hardly like we sitting here in the United Kingdom have a highly effectively functioning political constitutional system. But in other countries, there seems to be at least the possibility of kind of dreaming about pushing for significant political reform, which could meaningfully redistribute power. And that seems very difficult to imagine in the United States as it's currently constructed.
I'm struck by you know, the Make America Great Again movement. Is that why again? I mean, America is great. I mean, its domination of the world economy is there for all to see. Its military prowess is extraordinary. Its technological prowess is extraordinary. I don't really get the MAGA movement. I do know it has cultural roots rather than economic roots. What I find puzzling, and what I think a lot of listeners will find puzzling, is why do they feel so the urgency and the necessity of actually saying what they say about Western Europe and the collapse of Western civilization? Why do they feel so paranoid about America's lack of greatness that they have a movement, Make It Great Again, when it palpably is great? You know, I don't understand the roots of what's happening on the American right, really.
Yeah.
How do you understand it?
I think this is what I would offer, which is to build on your observation that it has cultural rather than economic roots. I mean, I think it probably has economic roots that feed into it on some level, but it is fundamentally a cultural reaction. It's a cultural reaction against second wave feminism, against the civil rights movement, against the perception that the United States is becoming literally unrecognizable in terms of its complexion, its demographic makeup, the way its citizens interact with one another. And that's not wholly founded. I mean, that's founded on some empirical reality. I mean, you could say that the really big dramatic change of the last half century in the United States was even more important, one might say, than the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, was the 1965 Immigration Act that has transformed American society. So the period between the 1920s and the 1960s, the United States took in very few immigrants, and those that it did take in were from countries like the United Kingdom and Ireland. Since 1965, the United States has truly become, as it was in the late 19th century, a country of global immigration, with a level in particular of Latin American immigration and South Asian immigration, which has transformed its cities and transformed its economy in many ways. And this visible transformation of its society is one that on some level is deeply unsettling to many of the kinds of people who support Donald Trump. Now, it's not, of course, as always, is never as straightforward as that, because of course Donald Trump has also increased a bit the proportion of Latino voters who supported the Republican Party. He even increased the number of African American voters who supported the Republican Party, even while nevertheless large majorities of people of color continue to vote for Democrats. But there is a strong assertion that even while you may have, as you do in the United States, an ever more complex ethnic racial society, it becomes even more important to reassert a kind of cultural homogeneity. And hence the Christian nationalism and the return to an idea of a country that was held together by an idea of a providential hand which guided the United States towards its destiny. In many ways,
That's a fundamental sentence, isn't it, Adam? A providential intervention, almost divine intervention, its special destiny. That's the origins of American exceptionalism, which still, despite everything, it's still kind of, I mean, the survey evidence is extraordinary. I mean, it's still a fundamental tenet of American belief, isn't it?
So if you go back to, as I've done recently for something I wrote, if you look at the bicentennial celebrations and you read the speeches that President Gerald Ford gave in July 1976, you see a couple of things that are very interesting and useful contrast to today, 50 years later. So on the one hand, compared to the current president, Ford was very willing to acknowledge American mistakes, to talk about the United States as a work in progress, its values, in a way that Obama might have done, did later. Ford was able to talk about America as an endless work in progress, constantly working towards a more perfect union, towards the fulfillment of those promises of the Declaration of Independence that you talked about in your introduction, Will. On the other hand, Ford is unashamed and unabashed about talking about, in effect, the Christian underpinnings of the United States. He's completely unafraid about making assertions about the country's providential role in world history. And that was the mainstream position in 1976. Gerald Ford, of course, was a Republican. He'd succeeded Richard Nixon in extremely crisis-ridden circumstances. But he was speaking then in 1976 in a way that brought together a cross-party sense of common purpose, which wasn't to say that there weren't antagonists on the left, because there definitely were, and it wasn't that there wasn't a kind of racist right, because of course there still most definitely was in 1976. But he was able to build a consensus around those values, and so what I'm saying is that some of what you hear echoed in the MAGA movement is simply, can't we still say what we used to say in 1976 about God's controlling providence?
I understand that. At the same time, of course, belief in God and attendance at church has been falling away quite dramatically, hasn't it?
Exactly. And I think one of the many paradoxes here is that religious identification, so calling yourself an evangelical, most obviously, is no longer, kind of almost quite amusingly, tied to actual attendance or membership of an evangelical church. It's become a political signifier. So in a secularizing society, a search for a return to what people imagine, not wholly without foundation, to have been a more morally grounded society of the 1960s and 70s and earlier is surely part of what has driven this conservative reaction. It doesn't say it explains Donald Trump himself or many of the people around him, but it is in the mix there as people see a kind of rising tide of secular liberalism, which has controlled many and has indeed controlled many of the institutions, most obviously the universities, and has changed American society in demonstrable ways. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that the idea of equal marriage, of marriage of gay people, was would have been literally unimaginable. And now it has become entirely normalized. And that's merely one indicator of how society has actually changed quite rapidly in a direction which has unsurprisingly provoked a reaction, which is not to explain many of the particular dimensions of the Trump movement. It is part of the context, and everything seems so much more extreme as always in the United States.
Is this a phase that America is going through, or something that's going to become more deeply entrenched? Just a brief pause in the conversation to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, which is the organization behind the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences. We're a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. We champion the vital role of social science in our society, from education to government and business. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation.
One way of framing modern American history, as in the last 50 or 60 years, is to describe it as a second Reconstruction, to compare it with the first Reconstruction during and after the American Civil War. And if you do that, you can see some of the same progressive pushes, some of the same changes in constitutional form and the operation of the government and the relationship between citizens and the state, and you can also see the reaction. So in the Civil War was a revolutionary conflict in the sense that it liberated 4 million or so enslaved people, which was, among other things, a huge dispossession of property. And for a while after the American Civil War, the Southern states who had taken part in that rebellion were effectively disfranchised, excluded from participation in government in the United States, treated almost as if they were fully conquered territories for a short time. And during that period, three really transformative constitutional amendments were passed. The 13th Amendment that abolished slavery, the most important being the 14th Amendment, which defined American citizenship in the Constitution for the first time and did so in a way that created the problem that the current president is trying to destroy, which is the principle of birthright citizenship. If you're born in the United States, you're a citizen. So gave citizenship to formerly enslaved people, which is a radical move, which Britain and France, the slaveholding empires that had abolished slavery within the preceding 30 years, had of course not done, and then enfranchised these people. And you know, by 1870, and one of the ways of illustrating this is that in 1870 there were more black office holders in the United States, in the South, an acting governor of a state, black senators, black congressmen, black council members. There were more black office holders in the United States in 1870 than there were to be again until the mid-1970s. So you went in a period of very, very short time from a system of chattel slavery to the granting of citizenship and including voting rights to enslaved people, and a massively enhanced role, at least on paper for the federal government in preserving and protecting those equal citizenship rights. And then what you had was a reaction. You had a backlash led by or enabled by the Supreme Court, which led to a 30-year period in which African-American people were effectively excluded and excluded then for a century from public and political life in the United States. And so you can think about what's happened since the 1960s in a similar sort of way. You can see the same kind of model happening.
Got it. That's very illuminating, actually. And it reminds me, my American friends always tell me, is that, of course, slavery and race is, you know, the original sin. It's the founding fathers were slave owners. In that respect, they wrote those famous words, all men are created equal, as slave owners. And that's been an hypocrisy that actually has, from which America has suffered from for 250 years and is still not resolved.
Yes.
But, I mean, one thing that I do think we should discuss, the rise of disinformation, decline of truth, the spread of social media, the defense of the capacity to disinform or actually tell outright untruths on social media as freedom of speech, to resist any form of policing as an intrusion into liberty. I mean, that's become a kind of... that's become something which, I mean, we're talking in the wake of a ban in the UK on social media for under 16s. I mean, and I expect there to be more in other countries. Where's that come from? And is there any likelihood that Americans themselves will move in the same direction as the rest of the world?
Well, I mean, I imagine that the answer to that last question is no, for the reasons you allude to. And I think it would be difficult because of the Constitution. I think any such attempt would be challenged in the courts, and would probably the attempt to overrule it would probably be successful.
That's an example you would say of this tension between an ancient constitution that's impossible to change and modernity.
Yes, I mean, I suppose, you know, the opponents in the people in the United States who would, I'm sure, oppose any kind of ban on social media for under 16s, just as they oppose regulation of these mega tech companies in general, would say that a large part of the explanation for the economic dynamism in the United States that you described earlier, Will, comes from the United States' genuinely entrenched commitment to free speech and to individual liberty. And the argument against that is that what we're seeing now since over the last 20 years and the way that technology has changed is something that's so insidious, so different in qualitative terms from previous communication technological revolutions, the spread of newspapers, the invention of the spread of radio and television and, you know, computer games and things that caused a moral panic in the 1980s. But what we're seeing now is so qualitatively different, is literally, you know, rewires the way that people's brains work. It disconnects people from meaningful interpersonal contact. It exposes children to sexualized images and so on from an extraordinarily young age. And all of these things are qualitatively different from any previous kind of communications technological revolution, that it would justify a departure from established norms. And that is an argument that it seems that it is possible to make in other countries, including the UK. And it is extremely difficult to land that argument in the United States. And that is a political cultural difference that is reflected in the constitutional ossification.
Let's discuss Britain's relationship with the United States for a bit, and we'll wind up. I mean, we're obviously fascinated by it, and it has a big impact on us. I mean, it's American private equity companies and venture capitalists who stalk kind of the London financial markets, kind of American multinationals kind of account for, is it a fifth, is it a quarter of our GDP? I mean, let alone, you know, the impact of Netflix and kind of American culture on our lives. And of course, you know, now social media. You can say we should take as much interest in French or German elections as we do in American elections, but given the impact on us, it's that it's not stupid to be kind of fascinated by them. Is it? But do you sense that there's a rupture, that actually there's a recognition that maybe it's gone too far and that Britain has to strike out on its own a bit?
Yeah, this is really interesting, isn't it? I mean, for literally 100 years since the 1920s, British elites have been anxious about Americanization of British culture. And at various points they have been, and starting earlier than the 1920s, they've been extremely anxious, and correctly so, about the Americanization of our economy. And the reality of the balance of power militarily, which was, you know, obvious to Winston Churchill in 1940, as is, if anything, even more true now. And so, as I think one of Tony Blair's truths that he tried to communicate to the nation in his little essay a couple of weeks ago was our utter dependency on the United States in military terms. And if anything, that is more true now as British military power has declined than it has ever been previously. So on the one hand, this is a very old story. Throughout much of that, the last 100 years or so, there has been shifting pro- and anti-American alliances in British politics and British society. And there's been an anti-Americanism of the right, and there was perhaps more obviously to listeners an anti-Americanism of the left. And you think about, you know, CND and the height of the Cold War, which had a kind of anti-American dimension to it. And I think it'll be really, and it's interesting now to think about whether we're at a point where, depending on what happens in American politics over the next 2 to 3 to 4 years, whether we will start to see again in British politics, in a way that we haven't seen for several decades, political leaders trying to leverage a resentment of the United States, which would do in itself, would do nothing to remove our dependence on them, but which might, for the first time now, perhaps for a long time, be politically salient. I'd be interested to know what you think about that, actually, Will.
I think that the affection British feels towards Americans is real and genuine. I feel it myself. I mean, I'm an avid watcher of kind of Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm. I was very, very affected by Bob Dylan in the 1960s. American cinema remains innovative and compulsive, and I admire very much their innovation economy. I think it's an extraordinary phenomenon. And we speak the same language, actually, and it makes it. That said, it's obvious that Ukraine is an existential threat, and Europe has to stand together, and America doesn't feel the need to join us. There's also a sense, I think, that if you believe in system resilience, that too much of our pivot points as a country are held by Americans, not least, of course, you know, militarily, but also in terms of finance. And actually, it's time to become more adult and try and recast relationship as one between adults rather than supplicant and capricious donor, if you like. And Donald Trump, in that sense, I think has done a lot of, it's a wake up call in a way, but it's also done a lot of bad. Maybe the relationship did need recasting, and that Donald Trump has done us, paradoxically, some good by forcing it to happen. You know, I'm not the expert. You know, you are. that's my instinct. You know,
I think we are potentially at an inflection point in the relationship between Britain and the United States for the reasons that you're just articulating. I think that we've been able to rely on a benevolent American empire for many decades. And I think it is pretty clear now that whatever happens in the United States, and even if Donald Trump is succeeded by some more benign sounding Democrat, something fundamental has shifted in the relationship between the United States and Europe. And that particularly bears on the United Kingdom. And if we can't completely 100% rely on American support in a most fundamental security sense. And I mean, I think we probably could if push came to shove right now. But if we don't fully and truly believe that for the long-term future, then that has immense consequences for British politics. They're incredibly hard issues to deal with, aren't they? We are so entangled, as we've both been saying, we're so entangled and so dependent in an economic and military sense that charting to a path towards some kind of strategic autonomy is an extremely challenging thing to do. But I do think that is probably going to be part of the discourse in British politics in the coming years. You know, even while at the same time, Will, I mean, I see with my own children the way in which American culture is not just as it might have been for you or I when we were younger. We knew when we were consuming American culture. You'd just been listing some of the ways. You know, we would go to American films, we would listen to American music. Seems to me now that for, you know, people of the age of my students and my own children, American culture is just indistinguishable from culture.
Yeah.
You know, when they're on their phones, you know, looking at their TikTok or whatever, what is American, what isn't American? How do they even know the boundaries? And it's that, and that's not in itself either a good or a bad thing, but it seems to me that it is changing British culture, the culture of young people in this country, more rapidly than perhaps we've seen in previous generations. It's literally changing people's language, people's idioms, people's reference points. And that, I think, will continue no matter the what happens in the kind of political, military, and even the economic relationship.
Adam, great conversation. Thank you so much for giving up your time.
Thank you.
Really interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistle Down production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.